Good afternoon. This is Tennessee.
And I'm Laura.
And we are artists in residence at The Wave Farm with Free 103.9 and WGXC. And we are coming to you with our first report back from our 3 weeks now of field work on our project Wage Working.
We've interviewed a lot of people, we've met a lot of people, and we're really excited to share with you some of the stories and some of the people that we've met along the way. I think we're going to be presenting with three different folks and talking about the work that they do, and we're really looking forward to sharing that with you and also meeting more folks and presenting more stories in the near future.
So to give you just a little bit of information about our approach, we have pretty much met people... word of mouth, but the first interview that we did, we just walked in off the street and met a guy who owns a bicycle shop in Catskill. And we are trying to record stories of people and their relationship to their jobs and their work and what they do at work and how they feel about their work, what they've learned about themselves from the work that they do. And then we're also gathering sounds of the work. We learned a new term, actually, at a conference that we went to in New York City. We went to Megapolis. We took a little break from our residency to go back to the city. There's a cool crew of people there from Harvard University doing sonic ethnography. So they're anthropologists, but instead of going and watching people and taking notes and writing about what they do, they record the sounds, and then they make these beautiful compositions. So I don't know if I can speak for Laura, but I know that after I heard their work, I was like, yeah, that's what I'm doing, oral history and sonic ethnography. And so that experience last weekend definitely inspired how I edited some of my pieces.
Absolutely. I think as people who are pretty experienced making, or I can speak for myself, doing pretty traditional documentary work where it's very narrative-based, it's really nice to be able to take advantage of the opportunity to play a little bit and record the actual natural sounds in people's environments and figure out how to integrate those with the stories and let them create sort of acoustically rich sonic environments.
So should we listen to something?
I think so.
Okay, well, I have some of Brian queued up over here. Brian Hunter owns Catskill Cycles in Catskill, New York. And what you're going to hear is these tracks that I've edited, the length of the track corresponds roughly to the amount of time that it takes Brian to make a dollar. And I say roughly because although he sets an hourly wage, he's an independent business owner. And so he's putting all of the money in to keep the shop open, supplies. Sometimes he does people massive favors and, you know, doesn't charge his full rate. So it's, I think it's all across the board. So he gave us sort of a ballpark figure, and that's what I did the math on. And I'm not going to tell you what his hourly wage or what his hourly rate is. I'm sort of curious from listening if you get a sense of how much he makes.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that the hourly wage, you touched on this a little bit, but it's specifically for how much he makes repairing bikes. The repair rate, because I think that's just part of his business model.
Right. If we started factoring selling bikes and all that, it would get complicated.
We'd be math students.
Yes, and we're not math students. All right, folks, this is Brian Hunter at Catskill Cycles.
My name's Brian Hunter. I own Catskill Cycles in Catskill, New York. I service, sell, and just work on bikes. I enjoy what I do, so that makes going to work every day easy. The first thing you smell is degreaser and tires, and there's just nothing like it. I'm always thinking about it, especially because I do love bikes, so even if I'm not thinking directly about the work, I'm thinking about riding my bike. It doesn't, bother me to do it all the time. I mean, and, I go home. It's not like I'm here 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, I definitely... and purposeful about setting aside time to be at home and with my family. Even though I might be thinking about stuff, I mean, who doesn't think about their work, though, when they're at home? I'll wake up in the middle of the night, if I've had a problem at work repairing something, and it happens every now and then, I didn't try that, and next morning I'll go back in and wrap it up. So it's really rewarding when I see someone ride down the street with a big smile on their face on a bike that I worked on the day before and got going for them. And, to see people using their bikes for transportation and fun and fitness and know that I had a hand in it is certainly really rewarding.
Well, the work area back here, we have, I don't know, 300 square feet of area. Along one wall is a pegboard with tools and some accessories and components hanging from it. Angry Birds poster that my daughter gave me. A watercolor painting that my mother gave me, and some other artwork of my daughter's. And then there on the pegboard is the first dollar that I earned here in the shop. A guy named Lamont Davis came in and bought some tubes and a patch kit 5 minutes after I opened the door. An L-shaped workbench, probably, I don't know, 10 feet by 8 feet or so. A wheel truing stand. I love to build wheels because, you know, that's really the most important part of the bike, because that's what you're, you know, on. And it's nice to start with a hub, 32 spokes, and a rim, and then turn it into an integral part of the bicycle. It takes time. It's nothing that you can really rush through. I mean, the best wheel builders in the world still, you know, you can only do it so quick. And if you make a mistake, you can mess up the whole thing.
Okay, that was actually two tracks of Brian Hunter. For those of you that had your stopwatches out and you were trying to figure out what the rate was, that was $2. So now this next one I'm going to play without butting up another one, so you can get more of a sense of how long it takes for him to make a dollar repairing bikes.
Customer service skills would be the most important part of this job, and just being able to interact with anybody that walks through that door and make them feel comfortable. Helping them discover, you know, the type of bike that they want to ride, helping them figure out what is wrong with their bicycle and needs to be done. And
hey, Daryl.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Not much. What about you?
Oh, you know, just working on bikes. Need some air or two?
I don't know what I need.
Did it go flat suddenly, or has it been sitting for a while? Or?
I think it went flat. I don't know, the woman uses it more than I do.
Anything that has wheels. Strollers, wheelbarrows, those electric chair things, all kinds of stuff. Tricycles, unicycles. The variety of people that come in as well is really nice, to meet all kinds of people from every race and socioeconomic background is really rewarding, to interact with so many different types of people.
It doesn't seem to be leaking. If it is, it's a really slow leak, so I'm going to put air in the tires and, if you know, bring it back tomorrow.
If you won't hold on to it, then have no rush for it.
Okay.
This way, I don't have to bring it back.
Okay. Well, why don't you just stop back by tomorrow then?
All right.
So that's a little taste of Brian. I wonder if, I don't know, he was our first interview.
I think it's really interesting. I was there for the interview, but I haven't heard your edit of it yet. And so it's so interesting for me how much I feel like I actually am in that space and like the little details. And I'm hoping that people can hear, can sort of have that sense with them, and they can sort of imagine that space and feel like that they're there. And just little details that I noticed and loved, as I knew that one of the janglies was Brick, his dog's collar. You know, I don't know if anybody picked up on that at home, but or wherever you are, but
right, as opposed to some sort of tool that he's using in his shop. Yeah. I know it was interesting. He told a story about when he first opened his shop, and I asked him if he was nervous. And he talked about in like the first couple days, I guess it was, or week, that he was doing a lot of repairs and selling smaller parts and lots of tubes and patch kits, but he hadn't sold a bike. And that this woman came in, she walked in off the street. It was a 15-minute interaction, picked out a bike, bought it, walked out. And he never saw her again, but that one big purchase or one big sale kind of set things off for him. And then people started coming in and buying bikes. And it's interesting for me because, you know, we met Brian within the first couple of days of being up in Acre and exploring Green in Columbia County, but we hadn't yet interviewed anybody. And it was like, we made this bold decision. We're like, we're just going to go in this bike shop. This guy has a smile on his face. And then as soon as we talked to him, it was, that was kind of like our bike sale. Then we were off and running with doing interviews.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting when you start a project like this, like how do you get your momentum up? And I think for us, we just decided we needed to walk in and get going. And Brian's been awesome in terms of also giving us ideas of other folks that we should be interviewing and talking to. And it's great to know a bike repair guy in the area.
Totally. And he also connected us with this bike ride that we went on today over in Chatham in Columbia County, Sean's ride. So not only are we getting things for our project, but we're also just learning a lot about this community. And it's a totally incredible place. And I'm very much in love with hanging out here.
Yeah.
I'm going to play.
If you want to hang out with Brian or if you want to visit his shop, it's in downtown Catskill on Main Street, I believe, right?
Yep. So I'm going to play the last three tracks. And I'm just going to merge them all together.
Cool.
So here is a little bit more of Brian, and then we'll be back. And I think Laura has some exciting things to play for us too. Let me just cue this up. All right, here we go.
One of the things that I make sure I do with every customer is look the bike over, talk through them what I'm going to do and how much it's going to cost. Make sure they're okay with that before they leave. And then also let them know, you know, if something does come up, I'm going to call you and let you know what it is before I proceed. So not all places that, in my experience, have done that.
I mean, that's better. It's up to you. You replace cables wouldn't do a whole lot. Replacing cables and housing would do a lot.
My boss or my customers, you know, I don't, yeah, as long as I keep my customers happy, then, you know, I'm doing a good job.
14. Oh, wait, is your change?
Thank you, sir. Thank you. I'll stop in later. Take it easy, man.
See ya.
I know some places maybe charge a little less. A lot of places charge more, but I just try to be fair and at the same time fair to myself as well.
Bye-bye. Hey, Larry, how are you? Your back wheel was pretty out of true, so I straightened that up.
I have kind of a menu that I go off of, you know, basic tune-up is $50, and that includes, you know, cleaning the bike up, replacing any cables that need to be replaced, truing the wheels if they need it, adjusting the drivetrain, the derailleurs, and the brakes. And, you know, the basic tune-up that I just mentioned takes about an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Need more?
That's it. Take care, man.
See you, Larry. Thank you.
You're welcome. I just, hopefully this thing is safe now.
I hope so, too.
Go up and down the road, you know. I don't want to hurt anybody.
Come in here and hang out in the shop because that's what I used to do. And, you know, when I first opened, you know, they would come in with their bike and need a tire, a tube changed or need their chain tightened, and I'd grab the bike and throw it on the rack and do it myself. And I quickly realized, not that they were taking advantage of me, but that wasn't sustainable. So I would then change that to, I let them use my tools to do the work themselves, and that way I don't have to take my time away from other bikes that I'm working on. And it also helps them to learn how to work on their bike as well. I think that's advocating, just encouraging kids to be out and about and biking and making them feel comfortable here in the shop. They know they can come back here and grab a tool if they want to use it. It makes me feel good that, you know, this is, you know, a place that they feel comfortable to come and hang out and work on their bikes. And I definitely get pride from that, for sure. I've learned patience. I've never really been a very patient person, but this has definitely taught me a lot of patience. Catskill Cycles, this is Brian. Hey. Yeah, I am kind of busy right now. I'm not hanging up on you, Danny. I'm just telling you that I'm busy right now. Okay, thanks. Especially when I get backed up in the back with a bunch of bikes that I need to have done. You know, the mechanical part of working on the bicycles, working through problems, I mean, it's you know, there's a lot to it, but at the same time, you know, it's pretty easy, but just time-consuming. If you get impatient and start to rush, that's when you make mistakes. So you have to just take your time, take a few deep breaths, and
and relax and work through it. And you have to be very precise and make sure that you do everything, you know, as it should be done, or else, you know, something bad could happen.
All right. So work in progress there, but Brian Hunter, Catskill Cycles.
Brian, yeah. So I think it's always one of the things that's been interesting about this project is since we came up here with a proposal and a pretty good idea of what we're doing, but something exciting happened to us today, or not today, this week. Our jukebox arrived. And so in addition to playing these songs on air, they will be living in a jukebox. Long-term location to be determined, but and we've decided that we're going to create albums for each of the people we interview so that we think of our interview subjects as more like rock stars and give them the rock star treatment with their own album in our jukebox. So we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah, and so there'll be multiple tracks with these different recordings. Some of them ambient recordings of people at work, some of them stories, some of them a mixture of the two, and you'll be able to put in a dollar and play some of these tracks. And yeah, we're excited to be able to leave the jukebox as a present to WGXC too. So what do you have for us, Laura?
So one of our first interviews that we had was with Mary Spring, who is a forester. I'll let her tell you what that means and what that's all about. And in this piece, I've edited it similarly where there are tracks and each track corresponds to the length of time it takes her to earn a dollar. But for this, I've put them all together. You'll hear slight pauses in between for the tracks. But yeah, for the whole piece, in case you can't hear the pauses or don't want to think about that, she makes $9.30 during the course of this piece.
Wow. And do you want to, should we talk? I think our process is reflected in how we found Mary Spring too.
Yeah. Well, why don't you take that? You're the one that.
Well, so one of the ways that I'm exploring green in Columbia County is on my feet. I'm a runner, and I went for a run on Route 23 and went up the hill towards Windham and passed by a place called the Agroforestry Center, which is not a center for angry trees, despite the fact that it's called agroforestry, but it's agriculture and forestry. And it's part of the cooperative extension through Cornell University. And I came back down. And I was like, Laura, let's go up there and check it out. And we went up there. And Marilyn Wyman welcomed us and just started to explain so much about forestry and really felt like it was an important place for us to take our project. And we said, okay, we've got a couple people lined up to interview and they're men and we need to talk to a woman. And she said, Mary Spring, she's a forester. She's born and raised in Greene County. She's the person. So shout out to Marilyn for helping us hook this interview up.
Yeah. All right, then I guess we'll have Mary take it away.
Okay.
For a song for a second. I'm not really sure what's going on in terms of this.
We're not hearing Mary Spring. So do you want to explain the song concept?
So the song concept is this jukebox, which we ordered off the internet, came pre-packed with 100 CDs. We didn't get to select what these CDs were. This jukebox, in its former life, which we know very little about, came with these CDs, and we have been going through the CDs and, you know, popping them into the car, not really looking what's on them. But we are paying particular close attention to the songs in the jukebox that just happen to be about work and people's relationship to their work, kind of like our project. So
So I grabbed a handful of CDs. I looked at I only picked CDs where the songs were written on the CD, and if there's the word work or money or something related to it in the title, I grabbed it. So, grab bag song here. Who knows what we're going to get?
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1. If you've got the money, honey, I've got the time. We'll go honky-tonkin' and we'll have a time. We'll have more fun, baby, all the way down the line. If you've got the money, honey, I've got the time. There ain't no need to tarry. Let's start out. You've got money, honey, I've got the time.
All right. We were noting that that song actually isn't about working, but it is about the relationship between time and money, which is another component that we are working with in our project. So it seemed to fit. And it's a great song.
Yeah. Thanks, Laura, for covering me on that one, because I clearly don't know anything about Willie Nelson or what his songs are about, because I'm the one that picked that song out.
There is a great Willie Nelson portrait in The Spotty Dog, so I feel like that's another reason that it's very appropriate to play him on our show, because the people at The Spotty Dog have also been very useful in connecting us to people in the local community. So if you want to see a hand-drawn portrait of Willie Nelson, you can stop by The Spotty Dog in Hudson.
Excellent. All right, we're going to go again with Mary Spring.
We're going to give this another go. So here's Mary Spring.
My name is Mary Spring. I'm a consulting forester in the Catskill Mountain regions of New York State. Well, I grew up in the Catskills, and I've always enjoyed being outside in the woods. And I worked as a bench jeweler for about 5 years, and I really got tired of being inside all of the time. My brother is a logger, and he let me know about Dutch elm disease and American chestnut blight. It got this horrible disease, and it basically wiped out this tree species that at one time was one of the dominant species that we had in the woods. And to think that this all happened before I was even born, that there was this tree that is not there anymore, it's just gone. And that concept to me said, I can go into this career and I can stop this kind of thing. And of course, you know, it's much bigger than any one person, so I'm a little bit more realistic about that now. I do have a favorite tree species. Eastern hemlock is one of my very favorite trees. I just always loved a hemlock forest, especially after it snows, and the darkness and the density and just seeing those boughs covered with snow. I've always loved that, and that's one of the reasons why I'm really kind of heartbroken about this hemlock woolly adelgid that's moved in that's going to create massive mortality among hemlock in the area. To be a forester means that I'm involved in the art and science of growing trees and doing it sustainably. The premise of sustainable silviculture is oftentimes to go in and cut the worst trees on a stand. By that, I mean trees that have damage to them that they will never grow into a big, beautiful, healthy, nice tree. Yeah, it kind of bothers me to see a tree be cut, and, you know, it's sad. You can get emotionally attached to trees, kind of can be a stumbling block, but I learned a lot about the real life cycle of trees and forests and how succession happens. And the thing is, if you have a stand of a forest of completely all mature, let's say old growth, that you think that if you leave it there, it's just going to be growing there forever. And it isn't. There's no light conditions on the ground. There, if you look at the ground, there are no young trees. There's not a next generation coming up to replace those older trees so that when they do die, you're going to be left with a situation where you have no trees. And that is one of the ways in which we use silviculture and tree cutting to regenerate a forest and create the next generation of young trees that's going to take over for the ones that die off eventually, the mature, the old people of the forest, so to speak. Well, when I come to a property, let's say, oftentimes the first contact I have with that property is with the landowner. And the first thing I'll do with them when I'm walking through is just kind of talk to them about what their objectives are for the property. I mean, what are the things, the reasons that they have that property? What makes it important to them? And then from that, once I clarify that, we can kind of go into the management options that they have.
I'm just looking at your little stand of hickories here. This is kind of cool, because like I was talking about, there not being enough regeneration. This is actually a nice little stand here of future big trees, but you can see how dense they are in there, and that there are differences in the diameter. That's not because they're different ages. They're all the same age in that group. But the smaller ones are kind of the runts in the litter, and the larger ones are the ones that you would want to favor to grow into the next forest. I charge $45 an hour, which sounds like a lot of money, but it really doesn't work out to be much
much in my pocket at the end of the day, you know, and lots of times I put in time over what I charge people for just because I like to keep my rates reasonable. I do consider myself an environmentalist, and I know that there's probably people that say, well, if she's advocating cutting trees in any way, that makes her not an environmentalist. But the reason that I advocate cutting certain trees in certain situations is because in the long term, it's going to be better for the forest as a whole and the health of the forest and the species diversity and genetic quality and wildlife habitat. It's going to enhance all those things. Anything that I do, if it doesn't enhance those things, then I don't do it. If you take this attitude that, no, I don't want to see trees cut, I don't even want to drive past a woodlot that's being managed, doesn't matter if there's a forester involved or not, I don't even want to see it. And yet, you're sitting down and you're printing things out of your computer, and where do you think this paper and pulp is going to come from? Our needs are still going to be met from a forest somewhere. And usually, if it's not in this country, it's going to be from South American rainforests. When those trees are cut, it's a totally different forest type. And that is completely unsustainable because when you cut those forests that have been there for thousands of years, they're just never going to come back. Whereas our northeastern forests are much more resilient and much more able to be regenerated. In my mind, good forestry is environmentalism. Well, unfortunately, I'm never able to completely shut off because this really is my whole life. You know, I'll be home in the evenings doing readings and doing web searches and staying current on everything that's happening. And then, of course, being self-employed, you're never able to completely just shut off. I mean, I like to maybe like 8:30 or 9 at night, just shut the phone off and decompress a little bit. But it's kind of something that it's not just a job for me. It's not 9 to 5. Okay, forget about it after that. It's something that's always there and I'm always thinking about it. And, you know, I try not to take the new invasives too personally as far as me saying, oh, I got to do something about emerald ash borer. And yeah, you never stop thinking about that stuff. It's always there in the back of your mind. Sometimes I'll get out of the woods early in the afternoon and go home and just immerse myself in weeding my carrots or something. And then when I'm weeding my carrots, I'm thinking about, well, this is just like trees. This is how trees grow. If you seed carrots and you don't thin them out, you're going to have a bunch of stunted little carrots that never grow to their full potential. So I often wind up thinking about that type of thing when I'm doing something totally different. My favorite part of the job would be all the time that I get to spend out in the woods. You know, I often get to the point where I take it for granted, and I think of people that are sitting somewhere in the middle of the week in an office cubicle, and they're just looking forward to getting out this weekend and going hiking somewhere. And I actually get to go out and do this for a living, and it's basically one of the reasons why I do what I do. That and the solitude. It's nice to be able to go out by yourself. When I went back to school for forestry, I thought, I'm just going to be out in the woods all day by myself. I do spend a lot of time consulting with people. And I do have some social anxiety in terms of meeting new people. Everyone that I meet is so nice, you know, and they want to hear what I have to say. So that helps me to get over my shyness. It has been a challenge, and that's probably one of the biggest ways that I've grown from this is being more comfortable dealing with complete strangers. Whereas I used to want to just go off in the woods and hide, but now I'm, like I say, I have something to say, I have a message to get out there, and I have to meet with people and talk to people in order for that to happen. Mike Greason kind of took me under his wing and got me interested in sustainable forestry and pushed me to go back to school. Anybody that ever met Mike knew that he was just the most friendly, affable, always smiling, always laughing kind of person, and I can tend to be more pessimistic. And Mike was always very outspoken about the message that we're trying to get out there. Now, Mike has since passed, and I'm kind of carrying on his legacy. Well, whenever I get down or I get pessimistic about having chose this as a career, I think of Mike and I think of the bigger picture, and I try and remove myself from just being this one person in this little 9-to-5 job here and get more of a mission to it. You know, I think everybody has to try and get some kind of a mission to their life in order to give it meaning. And if I'm out there in the woods and I'm walking through a big patch of rose bushes or multiflora rose or something that's thorny and hard to walk through or underbrush, I think of Mike and I think, well, you know, I'm really lucky that he was in my life at the time and pushed me in this direction, because I don't think I would have come across it on my own, you know, so. One of the ways that I've noticed things have changed over my lifetime is that the size of ownerships have decreased. It used to be, even when I was a kid, there were a lot more farms. So there were larger farms and, you know, part of the farm would be open field and then there would always be a woodlot or part of it forested. And because of the economic climate and just the agriculture being so hard for people to stay in and keep the family farm, a lot of the ownerships have been sold and divided into smaller ownerships. We do need to practice forestry and good silviculture, and yet economic realities often don't allow people to do that because, you know, if somebody is trying to pay their property taxes and they really need to come up with money, or, you know, heaven forbid they have some kind of emergency that they need cash, and they're oftentimes pushed into the wrong decision out of just necessity. And I could go out in the woods and be a commissioned forester and mark things and get a percentage of the sale and make a lot more money than I'm making right now doing things the way that I am. But my ethical responsibility is to do things the right way. Basically, high grading would be going in and cutting the very best trees in a woodlot and leaving basically the runts and the lesser trees as your seed source for the next generation. And because that goes on so many different cutting cycles, you just get to this point where our forests are really degraded. Basically, disease resistance comes with that. I feel like I've inherited this position, and I'm coming into this career at a time where really I have to clean up a lot of the mess that was created by people and even foresters before me. If you want to keep this land in forest, you have to plan for the future, and it may not be something that you see any benefit in your lifetime, at least not financially. And I know a lot of the things that I manage, I won't see the mature point of some of the trees that I work with, but somebody else will. And, you know, just as I took over the legacy for Mike Greason, someone down the road will take over this legacy for me. And that's what I'm preparing them for, preparing the forest for.
All right. That was Mary Spring, who was very generous with her time. We interviewed her for quite a while, and then she walked through a forest with us. And what the next phase of that project is, sort of taking the sounds of going around in the forest with her and integrating that a little bit into the interviews and sort of getting a really nice picture of and sound of what her job is like. But it's a great example of something which I knew absolutely nothing about. And just having the opportunity to be introduced to Mary and to ask her to just explain this area that I know nothing about and be able to share that with other people and understand how important it is and what that means specifically for this area.
I think one of the things specifically about talking to Mary, but everybody that we've interviewed so far, is this really powerful intersection for me of learning about the local area.
Mm-hmm.
What people who are living here are facing, what the challenges are, what they're proud of, what they're celebrating. I also feel like I've learned a lot about life and how to be a better person, and just gleaned a lot in terms of, oh yeah, in terms of my own ritual around work, things that I can do to strengthen my practice, and just kind of a little fire under my butt. You know, you listen to somebody like Mary talk, who just is driving and motivating herself, and she's up against a lot And it's mm-hmm. and it's really inspiring. And then to think, wow, you just took, you know, a big chunk of time out of your day to, you know, explain that what you care so much about to two strangers. So it's been a real privilege to be here and doing this residency. And just this blend of oral history and transmission arts is really fun.
Yeah.
One of my first jobs in Western New York, where I'm from, was working at a ski area. And so, of course, I had to go back to my roots a little bit. And I decided to go up to Hunter Mountain to find somebody working up there. Hunter Mountain is one of the major employers in Greene County. So I thought that was important. And I specifically had it in mind that I wanted to talk to somebody who was a lift operator. So for those of you that don't ski,
like me,
like Lori, you go to the ski area, you got to get to the top of the hill, you get on a chair, which hangs from a cable, which is suspended from some towers. And the person at the bottom who makes sure that that's a safe experience for you is somebody like George Pitluga, who I went and talked to. And the ski season ended the day that I was there, April 15th. And now George is up there at Hunter Mountain doing Tap New York and slogging ice around and making sure people, you know, are having a fun time eating fine sausage and drinking nice beer. I don't know what else to say about this. I guess I'll just play it for you. Maybe you should know, though, that the length of these two tracks is the amount of time that it would take George to make $2.
I wasn't snowmaking before this. That's how I ended up over here. You're only a snowmaker for a couple months, and then you get shipped to a different department. And I ended up here at Lifts and ended up staying. And I'm George Pitluga. Been here at Hunter Mountain for 3 years. Used to the cold, and I ski. So it makes it a good thing for winter. Hey, just a lot of fun people to work with and get to enjoy all the guests and meet lots of interesting people. Everybody says their goodbyes today because it's the last day. So, well, for the past few days, last week, you know, there's a lot of people that know me, and so that's how it goes. It's kind of sad. Bottom of Baker, George. All right. It was your buddy Pete on the west side.
What did he say?
I don't know. He was looking for you. It's like a big family here. A lot of the people have been here for a long time. And then you have all your newbies every year, which are usually kids. It's very hard to get a job. Work's tough, and we're in the mountains. We're in the middle of nowhere. There aren't very many employment opportunities. I get up at 4:30 in the morning. I have an outside wood stove, so I have to go deal with the fire and get ready and drive here. I pick up my coworker here. He rides in with me. And then we get here and we have to prep the lifts. Like, it's been warm. We have no ramp, so we have to move snow. This is our corral out here, and it'll be set up for a lot of people and a singles lane. And what we have to do at that point, which is usually weekends, is direct people in, so that every chair has 4 people in a chair. When we're busy, there's 8, 10, 11,000 people. And like today, there's what, like 400 maybe? So you're constantly working your ramp, keeping it safe, loading people safely on the chair, which is always a task. Because we do have beginners on this lift, it makes it difficult. You don't want anybody getting hurt, so you really have to be on your toes when you're loading chairs. I mean, it's a moving chair that has no mercy. So there's accidents all the time. I mean, people get hit by the chair. This is the hardest lift. One, it's the heaviest chair. That chair probably weighs about 400 pounds. So when you swing that all day long, I mean, you have to be physically fit to run this lift. to the stress level on this lift, because it is a beginner lift, grabbing it and speeding it up to slow it down. So when you see him grab the chair, he's yanking it forward to, because of the way it's grabbed onto the wire. So it speeds it up, and then you kick it back, and it actually slows the chair down to scoop him up. If you didn't do that, they're just going to get smashed by the chair. Your arm will be dead by the end of the day. On a busy day, a day like today, it's, well, you're not swinging very many chairs, but when this place is packed, it's every chair. You can have a little bit of adjustment that you can do to load somebody right. I mean, sometimes you have to, like, really pull back on the chair to scoop them up. Can't believe the stuff people do. They'll jump right out in front of the chair. Now, this thing takes 15 feet to stop. So when you press stop, that chair is going 15 feet before it stops. So if you jump out in front of the chair, you're getting clobbered. And, excuse me, I have to answer the phone.
Have the insurance.
74. Who? Oh, Adrian. Okay. All right. Thanks. Bye. Our boss is coming down the list.
She's on 74.
What's your favorite part of the job?
4:30.
I don't know. Just being able to hang out with your coworkers, and I mean, we have a lot of fun, laugh and joke. And you have to endure the cold, and you do a lot of shoveling. You can't be afraid of a shovel. When we're busy and the snow is, yeah, the snow is right, they actually keep dragging snow through. So what happens is this mat gets full, and you're constantly scraping snow off of here so it doesn't get built up. You might shovel, I don't know, 4 tons of snow in a day. We try to make it nice, like in the winter when we have lots of snow, we build sculptures, and we always make a giant bee for bee lift. Bottom and Baker, Jorge. Si, senor. Yep. I think he said 63. Hi, Gary.
What are you doing?
How's it going?
Very well.
I know, you never know it. So, ready?
Oh, how you doing?
Enjoy your run, guys. Wilson!
Georgie!
This is always the gathering place. Because it's the most happening lift, I guess. But it's a very popular lift, I guess.
For the park clown.
All set? You can see what kind of load people get by how they sit in the chair. If they're staggered like that, the last person is getting smacked. Ready? How's it going?
There you go.
Right on, new board. Right on. Hey, Nick, good. How you doing today? Okay. There we go.
How are we doing?
Good.
All right. See, it's a kind of a beginner lift too, so you get a mix of everybody.
Ready? Here we go. How's it going?
Great.
Go get them.
I wish the sun would come out.
I know.
No sun today.
How's it going?
If I can get the skating down, it'd be easy.
Getting there?
I can't get that down.
A little better than most.
Yeah.
There you go.
Thanks, buddy.
How's it going?
Good.
Oh, she's smiling now.
All right, pick your feet up. Okay, there we go.
What's up, boys? How's the park?
It's all right.
It's lumpy.
It's seen better days.
I bet. She's a beat. End of the season. Uh-oh, snowball fight.
Start making that lift move quicker.
I can't.
Get some of this.
Bottom Baker, George. Oh, come on, Rex. Tell them to walk down. No stop sign. Oh, Christ. All right, giddy up. See, never a dull moment.
Never a dull moment in the life of George Pitluga.
There are so many gems in that piece. I love it. I love it. I love the giddy up. I like all the phone stuff. It's looking pretty good. Yeah, it sounds great.
Well, that was the wage working report back, and we'll have more to report back next Saturday.
Yes, indeed. And if you want to be involved, if you want to tell us about what you do, if you want us to come visit you at your workplace, you can get in touch with us by emailing us at wageworking@gmail.com or call us at 518-314-9675. And we are keeping sort of an online blog website, keeping everybody up to date on what we're doing. We're taking some photos, actually. This is primarily an audio piece, but we do try to do a little photo here and there. So that website is wageworking.com. So we'll be updating that as we go along and hopefully be directing you all to the content that we're creating as well.
Yeah, and let us know what you think about what you've heard. And thanks for having us, Greene County and Columbia County.
Thanks for all your stories.